right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right. Back again. And we have a packed show for you today, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time digging into all the particulars, except I will tell you that at the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing a very special piece from Bob Avakian called, taken from his dialogue, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And the piece that we're going to be listening to is What If? And what he's talking about is what if we could have a whole different world? And before that, we'll be listening to an interview I did a little while ago with author Margaret Reagan. And Margaret is the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. And I thought that it was really important to bring these stories back out to you, given the situation with Trump and what they're doing against immigrants these days. It's very, very important, sisters and brothers, for everybody to understand this situation deeply. And this goes a long way to helping you do that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be talking with George Prochnick. Now, George Prochnick is a writer for The New Yorker, and in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker, he had a piece called When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. Now, in the 1930s, Austrian writer Stefan Zweig was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934, and then he was in exile in 1941. He spent his final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, what he called a warning to future societies. He had learned firsthand what it meant to not take on fascism when it first arose. Quite a horror. And so without any further ado, let's jump into the interview that I did with George Prochnick just the other day. I interviewed George Prochnick. He's a writer, and he has an article in the February 6th edition of the New Yorker magazine. And his article was When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, and he, according to Stefan Zweig. And he wrote this, and he said, you know, he looked at in the 1930s, Stefan Zweig, as I said earlier, was the most translated author in the world. He fled Austria when the Nazis took over in 1934. He was in exile, and in 1941 he went into exile in the States, in the U.S. He spent the final months of his life furiously writing a memoir, and the memoir was a warning to the people of the future. All right. And he had learned firsthand what it meant not to take on fascism when it first arises, what the consequences are. So without any further ado, we're going to listen to this interview I did with George Prochnick just a couple days ago. Check this out. I recently read a piece in The New Yorker. It was a very powerful piece, and it was called According to Stefan Zweig, and it was by George Prochnick. When I read it, I thought, I've got to talk to George. I've got to have him on the show to talk about this because it is such a compelling piece and it's such a necessary and important piece today, given what's going on in the world. So I'm really happy to welcome George to the show. George, I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and for what you said about the piece.
Well, let's jump into this. You recently wrote a piece in The New Yorker about the Austrian writer Stefan Zweig and his memoir, The World of Yesterday, that he wrote in the summer of 1941. Tell people who Zweig was and why his memoir was so significant that you felt you had to write about this.
Well, Zweig was an affluent Austrian Jew. He grew up in Vienna at the height of its cosmopolitan glamour. He himself, from a very early age, decided that his vocation was writing and was successful immediately. He began writing poetry, then he was writing essays for newspapers, and everything that he did found an audience. He began then writing extremely popular short stories, political essays, eventually histories, a novel, biographies, a libretto, a play. Everything that Zweig did added to his worldly acclamation, and he saw himself, because he became so popular not just within Austria, but in fact worldwide. And at the pinnacle of his career in the mid-1920s, he was the most widely translated author in the world and quite possibly the most successful. He saw himself as representing all the values of humanism that he hoped the historical trends were going to affirm more and more as his life went on. The first, of course, terrible blow to this dream was the First World War, which shattered the original Habsburg Empire balance between different ethnic groups, which was a vexed balance, but one which, at least for a period of time, kept the worst aspects of prejudice and ethnic denigration in check. After that war, Zweig decided that more important to himself than being a celebrity author would be the project of doing what he could to promote tolerance, international humanism, etc. And even though he continued to write at an extraordinarily prolific rate, he spent even more time, arguably, organizing different conferences, giving talks, trying to bring together the leading humanists from everywhere, from the East as well as from the West, to talk about what could be done to ensure that the catastrophe of the First World War was not repeated. So throughout this time, leading up to the rise of fascism in the late 20s and early 30s, before Hitler actually came to power, Zweig felt that his own situation, despite his grave concern for other more vulnerable populations, that his own situation was relatively immune. And, of course, after the Nazis came to power, and eventually Austria as well, later in the 1930s, became threatened and collapsed and fell under Nazi rule, Zweig found himself suddenly among the refugee population that he had watched with compassion and with a terrible sense of premonition, dating way back to after 1933 when Hitler became chancellor. So after he himself left Austria, he went to England and then he went to the United States and eventually he ended up in Brazil. But in the United States, he did the bulk of work on his memoir in the summer of 1941, living in, of all places, a small town up the Hudson from New York City called Osnig. He lived in a house, a very modest house, not like the grand apartments and grand hotels in which he had spent most of his life, very close to Sing Sing prison. And he worked furiously on this memoir because he wasn't trying so much to preserve a record of his private existence. It says virtually nothing about his own domestic life. What he was trying to do was to look at what had happened to his generation and understand how even someone as privileged as himself, let alone the millions, without all the buffers that he had thought would barricade him against the worst effects of fascism, how those had all fallen away. So the document, what he ended up producing in an incredibly rapid rate, he was sometimes writing several hundred pages in a shorter period of a few weeks. What he ended up producing is this extraordinary, almost a record in real time of how a civilization which had seemed so secure and so invested in its progressive democratic values could have collapsed so utterly and in a relatively short period of time. He really tries to look at this, and I am convinced, having spent a great deal of time with this book, that there are lessons which are sadly very pertinent for us today.
That was one of the really important points that you made in this article. This whole idea of even the title of the book, The World of Yesterday, and he's speaking to an audience that clearly it's not an audience that was necessarily living in the time that he was writing about and was actually looking to the future. And if he actually could conceive of a future given what was going on in the world at the time and what the future might be. But that whole idea of speaking to people about what actually, this is a warning. This is a warning to the future. And I thought this, the point that he made is that it's a law of history that contemporaries are denied a recognition of the early beginnings of the great movements which determine their times. If you look throughout history, that has so much importance in seeing how things develop and how things get to the point that they get to.
That's absolutely correct. Everything that you just said. First of all, in terms of the book as a message to the future, I think he literally conceived of it as a kind of message in a bottle to the future. He knew that his own generation was going to be immersed in, as he said, the abyss and unspeakable hells for as long ahead in time as he himself, at the age of 60 when he was composing this, could see, or 59 and about to turn 60. But at the same time, he didn't think that the Nazis would ultimately destroy the planet. What he felt was that if there was anything that he could give to allow the next generation to rebuild civilization on sounder grounds, that there could be no higher mission he could take on. To your point where you mentioned how it's denied to contemporaries to see what will become the great or the most important movements of their time, this is something that Zweig very, very poignantly presents. When Hitler first began to make a name for himself, which was in the early 1920s, nobody took him seriously because he seemed a buffoon, uneducated, so crude and ultimately unlikable that the elite, the intellectuals, couldn't imagine that this person would ever become a threat to the entire German, Austrian, and ultimately global culture. You know, there's another scene that I think of in this context. This son of the writer Thomas Mann, Klaus Mann, who was also an author, described having seen Hitler early on at a Munich tea house. And he's watching Hitler stuff his face with these cream puffs, and he's, as he puts it, such a petty bourgeois pig and so nasty and so, in a visceral way, not a leader, not a figure who seems capable of inspiring for greater German glory, or let alone any kind of preserving any ideals of civilization. He says, this man can never be a threat to us. And he says, it's impossible. And I think in our own situation here, it's obviously the case that Trump had been around for many years in the public eye. No one who was in a position to stop him understood for a very long time that he might be capable of channeling some sort of mood of a large swath of the country that could ultimately sweep them into power.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. You know, one of the things that comes up, too, in your piece, and I thought it really made me pause, because at the same time as what you're talking about in terms of Zweig and what he began to understand, when he actually was out there, at one point, he even ended up applauding the Nazis for their ability to bring, I think you say, a renewed sense of passion and import to German elections. And I kept thinking about the whole idea that somebody can get in there and mix it up, and really the idea is to get people, set people's heads on fire, and then you can actually get in there and wrestle with some things. But this was a fairly stunning thing to see somebody who did care the way he cared about what was going on, and then at the same time to be sort of blindsided by this whole point of the Nazis had an ability to bring a renewed sense of passion and import to the German elections.
I think that's a very important point. And again, there are certainly people who looked on, who continue to look on. I've seen this phrase in a number of relatively mainstream conservative essays and sites now, but the idea that, well, what this president is doing is acting like a bull in the china shop. You know, we had a huge problem. Something had to happen. He's there. He's going to shake things up. And there's this almost sly little winking, joking sense that they're going to know how to rein this force in at the right time. And historically speaking, the idea that you can control a charismatic maverick at the moment you decide it's gone too far has just been disproven time and again. And I think we have to be very clear that the passions that a leader can excite, even though those passions may have different motivations and be from all sorts of different demographics with different goals in mind, they don't in any way validate the larger platform on which a charismatic leader runs. The passions may be real and sincere and have positive elements. That doesn't make anything that the leader himself represents something that we as a country can abide by.
And that's extremely important. I mean, again, you look at what's going on today and think about this. I mean, all the things that we got in the build-up to the election where it was like, look, the people from the Rust Belt are really coming forward. And it was this whole people who haven't voted, people who've been so alienated from the system. Mm-hmm. And finally, they found their hero. And when I'm reading your piece, I'm thinking, damn, it's like way too much. There's way too much similarity here.
Right. There were so many reasons to be skeptical that he would be a hero of those demographics who felt forgotten, disenfranchised, etc. I mean, beginning, of course, with his vast wealth and his notorious lack of generosity as a human being in every sense. But he said what people wanted to hear. And, I think another point that Zweig makes, though, that's relevant, because it's obvious that that vote is the Trump's words of, the forgotten man, that mattered. But another thing that Zweig points out about Hitler's ascendancy, the moment when he himself, Zweig himself, began to take Hitler seriously, was when he realized how much money was being spent on the different squads of young men that he saw training in these towns along the Austrian-German border. They would be driving new trucks, wearing these spanking new uniforms, and all very, very well healed in their appearance. And he realized that there were financial interests using the nascent Nazi Party as a front. And there was unquestionably also a great deal of moneyed interest behind Trump, and that shouldn't be lost sight of. And moneyed interests who have, since the election, however they voted, come to decide, well, maybe this can work in our favor after all. I mean, a friend was telling me recently of a friend of his who is involved with a hedge fund that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the initial weeks after Trump's election. Obviously, there's this enormous rally on Wall Street. So there has also been an acceptance of the more heinous, from the point of view of human rights, actions taken by the administration. I think, unfortunately, because the greed of people with money is so far still being gratified. So it isn't only that this one population found its hero. It's that another population found someone who would allow them to become that much richer and, in fact, increase the very socioeconomic inequalities that in some way made this president possible.
Now, let's move into this, because you say in your piece that Zweig recognized the crucial role of propaganda in eroding the conscience of the world at the time, and this was a massive boon to what Hitler was trying to do. Let's talk about that, because there seems to be a lot you can draw between that situation with Hitler and Trump.
Well, absolutely. One point that Zweig makes is that at the outset of the First World War, it was still possible for a poet, for an intellectual, for an eloquent voice to intervene in the clamor towards war and make a statement that even if it didn't halt the progress towards war, would at least cause enough of a controversy, enough of a dissension within that rush into bloodshed, that there was some hope that you could affect the course of history by sufficiently articulating the dangers of what lay ahead. But over the course of that war, what modern propaganda, what we think of as modern propaganda, really took hold and saturated all forms of media, not just print media, but radio as well. And Zweig documents to an extent how the very capacity to exaggerate the fear of strangers, the dangers posed by foreigners, became a self, not just self-perpetuating, but an expanding, snowballing phenomenon, so that by the end of the war, Zweig actually labeled what the press was doing as the doping of excitement, that there was just a need to produce a certain kind of effect on readers or listeners so that you would continue to have what we would today call an audience share. By the time the Second World War was becoming more and more imminent, Zweig says that the organization of lies, which is how he describes propaganda, had become so effective that it was no longer possible for anyone to say anything that could have the slightest effect on the rush into the madness that that terrible war became. And there were so many eloquent statements in the period leading up to our own election period. I think of Michelle Obama's rightly celebrated speech at the DNC convention and any number of other instances that if it was possible for words to matter to the whole population, they would have mattered at those moments. And unfortunately, it's obvious that our segmented news, our ability to curate our own news feeds through social media, our lack of any common standard of truth has led to a situation in which propaganda is now seen as by one side or the other, and I would argue infinitely more perniciously on the side of the right, it is now viewed as just the situation with news. You're looking for an affirmation of your opinion, not for some sort of a factual report. And in that situation, I don't know how you find common ground again.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking to George Prochnick, who's the author of a piece in The New Yorker called According to Stefan Zweig, a really important and chilling warning about the past and the future. Well, one of the things, too, though, that is very, very important in relation to all this is the fact that propaganda has that other role, which is, as you point out, is both actually whips up Hitler's base. That's what it did in Germany. It whipped up his base. And it covered for some of the most brutal things that he was doing as he was consolidating his hold on power. And that people actually didn't see the truth. They were blurred into wishful thinking. Truth was blurred into wishful thinking, even as all these terrible things were going on.
Absolutely. The combination, as you just said, of how propaganda can hide from people what's actually going on and stir sentiments to encourage the worst excesses. We've seen that. And we've also seen the last point that you made about how in a situation where everything feels so chaotic and dangerous, any gesture towards normalcy becomes something that people just grasp for desperately. And there was that long period in the run-up, both after the election and the period leading up to the election, when I felt as if Trump had only to not do anything awful for 24 hours, 36 hours, and you have extraordinary statements on the part of CNN where it began to sound as though this was a clear indication that he had converted and become just like any other politician. It took so little for people to want to project so much onto any sign that things were not going to be as disastrous as many people feared.
I have two more questions for you, and one is a question that you pose in the article, which is how far along the scale of moral degeneration Zweig would judge America to be today under Trump?
Well, I think that one heartening phenomenon here has obviously been the strength of the resistance to all sorts of different measures that have been promulgated by the White House. That has been the marches, the boycotts have shown that the population is hardly subdued. And there are lots of positive signs about of people's understanding that this has to sustain itself and build momentum. One thing that is clear about Trump's character is that he is capable of being thrown off balance. And I say only slightly tongue-in-cheek that I wish that some of the energy of the Occupy movement might turn into a pre-Occupy Trump movement. And I think this could take all sorts of different forms. More boycotts, strikes, obviously marches. Every possible effort to disrupt his own effort to give a veneer of everydayness to what is in fact a radical politics. So that's the good sign. I think in terms of where we are with news, where we are in terms of doubts about the checks and balance in our government, what's the sweep that the GOP had on every level, not just in terms of Congress, but in terms of the governorships, etc. Things are a lot rockier, particularly because the GOP has shown itself to be so absolutely spineless. The point that Zweig makes is that you can have that particularly dangerous equation of eroded shared values and eroded institutions, and things might still not tip all the way over until something catastrophic happens. In the case of Germany, less than 30 days after Hitler became chancellor, that was the Reichstag fire, the burning of the parliament building, which the Nazis blamed on the communists, and which there remains some doubt about today as to whether that might not in fact have been set by the Nazis themselves. But regardless, once that happened, Hitler immediately imposed a raft of emergency measures that shut down justice entirely. And what I worry about here is the big event, whatever form it takes, or the fabricated big event, but something that becomes an excuse. And we've already seen Trump manufacture terrorist incidents, manufacture the threat posed by different demographics in ways that could really spin things very quickly into a different place than we find ourselves in today.
Mm-hmm. Now, you answered a good part of my next question, but I'm going to read the last sentence in your article, and you can comment on it. You say the excruciating power of Zweig's memoir lies in the pain of looking back and seeing that there was a small window in which it was possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly and irrevocably that window can be slammed shut. That's sort of what you were just talking about now, but it's also something that really needs to be emphasized because, frankly, I'm really happy to see all of the resistance that's out in the streets, and we need, you know, there is a need for a whole hell of a lot more. There needs to be millions of people in the streets, millions and millions, to actually speak to the towering, you know, horrible situation that exists today. But I thought your last sentence really puts out a very sharp warning to people, a small window in which it's possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly it can be slammed shut.
Thanks, and I agree with you that what's happened so far, there needs to be more of it, and unfortunately, there's not going to be an opportunity to tire of it. This is not something that is going to go away quickly. In a best case scenario, I think there's a fight here that's going to have to be waged for a long time, and it's been heartening to see that enough Americans have a spirit of defiance of injustice, that they're willing to break up the routines of their own lives and speak out against what's going on. But we need more of it, and I really hope that the different groups, not only vulnerable, but different groups with different kinds of privilege, can find ways of resisting together, because it's only in a very powerful and relentless co-resistance that we're going to keep that window open long enough to actually get these people out of power.
All right. Thank you very much, George. I want to really express my appreciation for the article and for coming onto the show, too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with George Prochnick. Now, George is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. And it's also, he had an article in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker titled When It's Too Late to Stop Fascism, According to Stefan Zweig. And that's a don't miss piece. Check that out, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, da, emigrada, emigraniada. We're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher every time.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada.
Welcome back. That was Emigraniada from Gogo Bordello. Now we're going to be listening to an interview that I did with Margaret Reagan. She's the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. And sisters and brothers, I'm bringing these stories to you, this book, this interview to you, given the situation, the very, very vicious assault that immigrant communities are under right now. Immigrants are actually the first wave of those being attacked by the fascist regime. So check this out. I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest. And this is Margaret Reagan. And Margaret wrote a book that somebody actually pulled my shirt tail on it. They said, look, check this book out. You've got to. I'm starting to read it. It's just knocking me back in my seat. And I picked the book up and I started reading it. And quite literally, I read it and I spent an entire day reading it. And I just didn't want to stop. And I went from beginning to end and was extremely moved by this book. And it's the story of immigrants in the U.S. and in the entire North and Central America. You know, what's happening there? What's the story? And it's actually, I felt, and we'll talk with Margaret about this in a minute, but I felt that this was really a story that in this book, the thing that really, really holds on to you is that it's a constant struggle between the dehumanization of all these human beings that are forced to leave their home, to leave everything they know by the conditions there, and come to a place they know nothing about and desperately seeking to survive, or once they've been there, to stay here, versus what actually is the system that's actually bent on and constantly finding new ways to dehumanize all these people. And that was a theme that I think really, really, you know, winds through this entire book and in very creative and very moving ways. So Margaret, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. That was a wonderful introduction. I appreciate it.
Good. It was a wonderful book, sister. Really wonderful. I meant it clearly. I couldn't stop. I couldn't put it down until I finished it.
Wow.
So it was, yeah.
Great.
Let's tell people exactly what the book is about.
Okay, well, it kind of comes out of a previous work. I wrote a book 5 years ago about the deaths of immigrants in the Arizona desert, which is a huge issue here in, I live in Tucson, and I'm a reporter here in town, and so I started writing about these deaths long about 2000, and a book came out in 2010 called The Death of Joceline about how many people are dying. They're still dying out there. We're up to close to 3,000 bodies found in the last 15 years, which is a lot of bodies in just an American state, right, to find these bodies lying around on public lands often. But after that, you know, I learned some things when I was reporting on that book. I started learning about the detention centers, and I started meeting migrants on the border who, they were not first-time crossers. These were people who had lived in the United States for a long time and had families here and had been deported, and they're stuck across the other side of the border trying to get back home. So I decided to investigate this whole issue of people who did successfully cross the borders many years ago, have lived these very American lives, often have American citizen children. And then something happens, you know, some small event, they're driving with their taillight out or something on that level often, and they get caught. Their lives are upended. They're sent to these detention centers, which have appalling conditions. And eventually many of them are deported, and many, many of them are separated from their children. So it's a huge and ongoing issue. It's kind of like, this is the immigration story now, the fact that so many people are living here and this crisis is affecting them every day. And as you said, they live in fear, the ones who haven't been caught, that, you know, one day maybe their light will go out on the back of their car.
Yeah, you know, and it's very heavy, because when you lay this out in terms of the scope and the situation that people are facing, I mean, I am someone who has paid attention to this. At the same time, when I looked at the actual numbers and the scope, the breadth of this, I was stunned. And I want to, yeah, can you tell people, like, I want people to get a sense of, like, this, we're talking about so many millions of people. And when you divide your book up into detention and deportation, and when you add all of those figures together, this, and even with the taking into account the overlap, we're looking at a story of millions of people per year who are caught up in this and being eaten by this machinery.
Right. Well, typically in a single year, we have about 400,000 people cycling through the detention centers, not all being held at one time. We usually have about 35,000 being held on a given day, but over the course of year, 400,000 people being brought there, and approximately, you know, equivalent to that, about 400,000 being deported and what they call it, formal removal, every year. So, yeah, close to 1 million people affected in some way every single year, and then, you know, the numbers add up as you go on. I think Obama is up to, and, you know, he's been in office for, what now, 7 years almost, you know, his numbers are up to about 2 million deported. And, you know, that's been true with the previous presidents also.
You know, there's something, Margaret, that is really I was going to say this to the end, but I really want people to get this. The way you open up your book, I think it captures exactly what you're saying. You have this position. I mean, these are people, again, these are people who are just, they're looking for a way to stay alive. And it's like everything has been so screwed up, mainly by the workings of the economies of this society and what goes on with all this. And there's no work, NAFTA destroying all this stuff, in Mexico, and, you know, people just not being able to live in the ways that they did. And you present something in the beginning of the book that I found to be, again, sort of sucked me in right away. You presented this when I was talking about the constant tension between the humanity of the people and the constant assault on that humanity through the system and the people that defender are the enforcers of the system. You start with a beautiful portrait of what goes on at that wall. Can you just give people a sense of your take on that? It was a very poetic sense of that.
The wall.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, we're so used to this wall down here in Arizona. Yeah, it's this amazing thing. Every day you see lines of people being marched back over the border into Nogales. And then one of the most poignant things is, you know, a few years ago, they built a great big new, stronger wall. They had a fairly flimsy thing. It was, and this is a poetic metaphor also, the original wall was made out of helicopter landing flats that had been used in the Persian Gulf War and in Vietnam. It was Army surplus, but they were just these sort of junky-looking metal things. And 2011, the government decided to build these really thick, tall posts. These walls now go up about 20-25 feet, but they wanted the wall to be see-through, so they have 6 inches in between these posts. You can't get through it, but the Border Patrol wanted to be able to see who was on the other side if somebody was planning to try to climb over. It just gives them more information if they can see what's going on in Mexico. But one of the side effects of this has been that families meet between the wall. I witnessed, you know, a father on the American side. You know, he's in America. He goes down there to visit his wife and children. Little boy handing his school paper through the bars to his father. It's very heartbreaking. That wall's an improvement for families like that. But there's also a downside. We do have a case in which a Border Patrol agent stuck his gun through that see-through wall and shot a 16-year-old boy on the Mexican side. And that happened more than 3 years ago now. And right now there's a case going on. His mother has sued the federal government. They argue that because this did not take place in the United States, the death of the boy didn't take place in the United States, they don't have jurisdiction and nobody can be prosecuted. So the mother is challenging that in court right now. So.
It's interesting, too, though, because when you think about that, all the people, they just came out with some kind of decision. I can't remember who made it, whether it was the Border Patrol or the government, some branch of the U.S. government, that there's been so many shootings along the border.
Yeah.
no one's held responsible. It's all like, well, we can't prosecute anybody. You know, sorry, it was all in the line of duty, you know, which is like,
I know. Oof. If you think about it, if it were reversed, if a Mexican law enforcement officer aimed his gun through there and shot a 16-year-old kid in Arizona, you know, it would be a big international incident.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. Yeah, the Border Patrol is kind of notorious. You know, it's kind of parallel. We're learning a lot about the police in American cities right now with all these cases that we've been hearing of police fatal shootings of people on the streets. The Border Patrol has an amazing record of killings that they're always exonerated. Invariably, they're exonerated, and very few of them really get investigated to any level.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I wanted to also, though, go into this detention centers that you talk about, in which, to me, you know, look, I considered myself, okay, I know enough about this, or I know quite a bit about it, but not, and as your book pointed out, not nearly enough, because these detention centers, while I knew they existed, the scope, the magnitude of the repression that goes on inside the centers, but the scope of the centers themselves, the fact that they are all over the place, and then with this concentration in Arizona, which, you know, okay, what are we going to do about Arizona, huh?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, somebody wrote a book, The Trouble with Kansas. I guess we need another one, The Trouble with Arizona.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the same way when I started hearing about this. There are about 250 different detention centers around the United States. And one of the things that's the most astonishing about it is that we, the people of the United States, don't really operate them. Many, many, many of them are run by private prison companies under contract to the U.S. government, partly because, you know, this whole industry grew so quickly, you know, the government can't possibly afford to build its own. But these ones run by the private prison companies, that's Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, they're in the prison business. They're used to dealing with criminals, convicted criminals, felons, and so on in their private prisons. And that's their model. And these detention centers are not supposed to be punitive prisons. They are supposed to be civil detention, meaning people are not being held for a criminal punishment, but they're being held simply to assure that they will appear at their deportation hearings. But the people inside are treated exactly like prisoners. I visited the great big one in Arizona called Eloy Detention Center, which is the only one in Arizona that houses women. And I went there on a visiting day to visit this woman. I couldn't believe, I mean, I'm not familiar with criminal prisons either. So I went in there and I was shocked at the way that they treated the families. They sort of crowded them into this great big lobby. People had to wait for hours to visit their loved ones. The guards were yelling at the little kids. You know, one little boy was bored to tears. You know, he was playing on a gate, and this guard just yelled at him. I never saw anything like, oh, honey, are you here to visit your daddy today? You know, like most of us normally talk to little children like that in public. The whole thing was very, very harsh. And at this private prison, they also limit the family visits to very few hours. And by contrast, ICE, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has its own detention center a couple miles away in another town called Florence. And that place is run a lot better with family visits 7 days a week, all day long. The food is better. But we only run about something like 11 ourselves. Everything else is contracted out. And as we've been learning about the detention centers in Texas, they're poorly monitored. You know, that these companies are not necessarily complying with the regulations that they agree to when they get the contract.
Let me take a real quick break here and let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Margaret Regan. She's the author of a great book called Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. The thing that got me, too, is like the point you were just making about these are civil prisons, and people are not – these people who are in these detention centers, a lot of them have already done jail time. They're not supposed to be doing any more jail time. A lot of the people who are in there weren't meant to do jail time, but – the idea, as you're saying, that this has suddenly become, these are actually prisons. And one of the things that was really shocking, I think, to me, because I know something about solitary confinement and the impact it has on people, there's a regular standard of solitary confinement for people who break the rules or who are being unruly. You know, this is disgusting.
I know, it's very shocking. You know, we condemn the use of solitary confinement. Remember those three hikers that wandered over into Iran a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Americans, and they were held in solitary. And the woman, I don't remember her name, who was one of them, when she got out of there, finally, she came back and wrote how debilitating it is, and went on to make the very important point that, yes, we practice solitary confinement in our prisons in the United States, and shockingly, in these immigration detention centers. One of the women in my book that I interviewed, she was 61 years old, skewing pretty much older than, you know, the usual population there. And she told me she had these terrible anxiety attacks. She was a good living Catholic, you know, religious woman, worked hard all her life. It was so disturbing for her to be locked up in this tiny cell. She started having all these panic attacks and hive attacks. She kept going to the nurse at the Eloy Detention Center, and the nurse got angry at her for coming. And she said, if you come in here one more time, you will be placed in solitary, and that's as punishment for seeking medical care. And that woman finally said, just deport me. I cannot stand it anymore. And that's, you know, the criticism of these centers is that we allow them to be so harsh because that's what our goal secretly is. We don't want them to make use of the rights that we've afforded them to fight their case. We just want them out of here, and a lot of people just can't stand it. So they, you know, in a way, they self-deport.
Mm-hmm. It's heavy too, because you talked about Eloy, and then there's this other one that, and you know, which is sort of the garbage pail of the entire system. It seems the one that was connected up.
Pinal County Jail.
Yes.
That one was horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
That had been named one of the 10 worst, and the course of writing my book, I wrote all this stuff about it, and then all of a sudden ICE pulled their contract. It was so bad that even ICE couldn't tolerate it.
Yeah. You know, but what I was going to say is that in all these conditions, there's actually something that also, I think people don't think about very much, and that is suicides and the suicides that are on the rise within these detention centers.
Right. Yeah. Well, while I was writing this book, two young Guatemalans committed suicide in the Eloy Detention Center a few days apart. They both committed suicide, and neither one had even been there for very long. One was a young woman, one was a young man. And, you know, it came out that Eloy was not even abiding by the suicide prevention protocols that were set in place in their contract. And even more shocking, when ICE discovered that they weren't, the ICE statement was, we are negotiating with Corrections Corporation of America to bring their standards up to meet the legally required standard. And I'm thinking, negotiating? We're paying these people to do this job. The very least is we could insist that they abide by the conditions and the regulations. So, I mean, they did make changes after that. But, you know, there are a lot of people in despair up there. In Eloy, there are very many Guatemalan women who are seeking asylum. And they can be held for years. One woman I interviewed, when I haven't checked on her in a while, but she'd been there about 3 years because they can keep appealing their cases. And, you know, this is what we've been hearing about these mothers and children in Texas. They're applying for asylum. They're applying for asylum as refugees. And yet we're housing them in these, you know, really appalling conditions when they're just asking under international law for asylum for their fear, you know, their fear of being in their home country.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that the other part of your book, the other half of your book is on deportation. And one of the things that you bring out there that was really, I mean, it's just so moving in terms of how, again, people's lives. It's one thing you're picked up, you're shut down into these detention centers, you're separated off from everything. And many times the end result is being deported. And even after spending 6 years fighting to try and have some semblance of, okay, I can stay here, whatever. But the deportations and the brutal inhumanity that's unleashed with these deportations, I wanted to ask you very quickly about one person in particular that really stuck with me. I think her name is Elena Santiago.
Right. Uh-huh.
Very moving story, because I think it captures a lot of what happens to so many people.
Yeah. I mean, her story, you know, and she's still down there. She was a single mom with a teenager and a little toddler girl, and she was arrested by ICE at her house one morning. The kids were taken away from her and put in foster care with Child Protective Services because she had no family that they could go to. And she was deported within something like 24 hours of being picked up. She landed in Nogales, Sonora, which is the town right across from Nogales, Arizona, where they drop them off. She didn't have any identification with her, which proved to be a huge problem for her as time went on. She had no money. She had no extra clothes. She had nothing. She hadn't been in Mexico in 27 years, And here she lands in this town, which, you know, is kind of dangerous for a woman just hanging around on the streets. No idea what to do, where to go, no way to get in touch with her children. And her case, the only reason I know about her, I mean, there are many people like her that I don't know about who don't get help. An activist group located her, she found them, and they helped her get in touch with Child Protective Services and get on the phone, and she was able to speak to the children in foster care. But get this, she's in Nogales trying to rebuild her life, and the state of Arizona moves to sever her parental rights to the little girl, who was 2 or 3 at that point, because she was not an available mother. Because she was a deportee, she was not there to take care of her child. Therefore, she was an unfit mother. And the state moved to sever her parental rights to that little girl. The teenage boy was on his own. He can make the decision not to be adopted. But so she had to fight to maintain her parental rights to that child. So ultimately, she was able to get her back. But I witnessed the whole trial around this. It was on the phone. She wasn't allowed to attend the case, the hearing in Phoenix, because she's a deportee. So she's down there in Nogales on the phone, for Pete's sakes, and they're talking about whether or not they're going to remove her child from her permanently. And she was also not allowed to speak. She was only allowed to listen. And surprisingly, they did bring her the child back down there in Mexico. But she's really struggling down there. You know, she has this kid who's traumatized. They'd been apart for 14 months, and when they got back together, they didn't even speak the same language. The child no longer spoke Spanish, and the child is very disrupted. She became very attached to her foster mother, and she had a nicer place to live up in Phoenix. You know, now she's with a mother who's just scraping by in this kind of difficult Mexican city. So, yeah, it's a shocking thing how people are just dumped over there and they don't have any idea what to do.
You know, there's one thing, we have time for one last question for a few minutes, and I'll be quick with the question. You can, you know, do your answer. But the thing is the response. I think actually, you know, one of the things that really struck me too about another section of your book, which is called Resistance, and I felt that was so important and so inspiring, because similar to the situation where you have black and brown people being gunned down, wantonly gunned down all over the country just unbelievable numbers, and by the police and various other enforcers of authority here. But you also have, in this situation, you have people saying, we will not tolerate this any longer. And I was very inspired, particularly, I thought that the streamline example you gave was actually so good.
Wasn't
that amazing? Oh, it was great. It said, I'm sitting there going, yes, this is what we need more of on every front. We need more of this. You know? But give people just a sense of that. And then,
this is another interesting thing about immigration policy. They randomly select about 70 border crossers every day to prosecute, with the idea that if people hear on the other side that maybe they're going to end up in jail for crossing, usually they just get sent back, the early border crossers. So every day they randomly arrest 70 people, put them in the Border Patrol jail for a couple of days, and then they have these mass hearings before a federal judge. You've never seen anything like it in the United States. 70 people at once being tried. They come into the courtroom in chains and, handcuffs and chains around their feet. And they shuffle in, you know, it's like something out of the 18th century, seeing prisoners shuffled in like that. And they're all dirty and smelly from being in the desert. And they all plead guilty. They have a chance to meet with an attorney for 10 minutes a day. And they all plead guilty because, as one attorney said to me, it's all set up that way. If they plead not guilty, then they're going to be in prison for a lot longer because they're held there without bail until they can have a regular trial. So if they plead guilty, then they'll maybe be sent to jail for 3 months or 6 months, and then they'll get out. So they all plead guilty. They all say one by one, culpable, culpable. And then, you know, they're all convicted. So it's like a foregone conclusion every day, 70 people convicted in this mass trial. So a group of activists in Phoenix and in Tucson decided that they would stop the bus that brings the prisoners to the federal courthouse. And, I mean, I didn't know anything about it beforehand. Somebody called me, tipped me off to go down there that day. I saw the whole thing. It was, you know, the whole operation was done with military precision. They knew the routes that the two buses took, and they block the roadways. You know, a human chain that people just got in front of the buses, and of course the bus driver has to stop. And then they quickly, they had it all planned out, they chained themselves to the bus wheels so that they couldn't just arrest them and take them away easily. So it was just this amazing thing. They lay there on the ground for about 3 hours, chained to these buses. And, you know, this is Arizona, and it was hot. They were out there in the sun. And the immigrants are all on the buses, you know, wondering what's going on. And, of course, they all got arrested. But it turned out they did stop the streamlined hearings for that one day because there wasn't time for the immigrants to meet with their attorneys, which would have been unlawful. So they were very happy that they succeeded in canceling the hearings for that day, and as it happened, all those people were just let go. They were just deported instead of being tried and sentenced to a jail. So they were really happy, and by the way, their last of their court hearings was just a week or two ago, and the judge sentenced them to time served. They had all spent a night in jail. I think there were about 13 of them, people who got arrested. So they all were very happy. They felt, you know, had really been worth it bringing attention to the streamlined hearings.
Yep. All right, Margaret Regan, thank you very much for joining us on the show today, and thanks a hell of a lot for a really great book.
Oh, thanks so much, Michael.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Take care. Talk to you again soon. Bye.
Okay, bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Margaret Regan, the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. All right, we're running up against our time limit, and I want to bring this piece to you right away. All right, this is a piece from Bob Avakian, and it's taken from Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. Extremely important, brothers and sisters. It's all about what if is another world possible, and what could it be? Check this out.
And many people say, we need religion to be able to endure, to survive, to keep from going crazy, to continue to struggle on, even to have some moments of joy and glimmers of hope in a world full of so much cruelty and brutality, heartbreak and heartlessness. But what if the world doesn't have to be this way? What if we could live in a world where never again would a parent have to fear for the life of their child just because of the color of their skin? What if we lived in a world where never again would that soul-wrenching experience that never leaves of having to bury your own child whose life was stolen by a brutal thug with a gun and the backing of the powers that be? What if being black no longer meant living in a white supremacist society that continually assaults you in your very being and very sense of worth, constantly subjects you to terror, openly or in more subtle ways, and forces you to face the constant danger that you or your children will have your life snuffed out at any moment for doing nothing but being? What if your humanity really mattered and were considered precious? What if this were true of all people of color and of immigrants? What in fact, if all people were just people of different colors, and there were no distinctions and discrimination and persecution and brutality based on what nationality or race you were? What if there were no such thing as immigrants? What if we all lived in a world community of human beings without borders and tanks and guns and planes to enforce them?
Yes, yes, yes.
What if women could walk down the street and look every man they encounter straight in the eye and fear nothing, and not be made to feel and not be made to feel that you're on display and to be evaluated by how you sexually titillate them. What if no more women were ever again battered, raped, assaulted, denied the right to control their own bodies?
That's right.
What if people who were different in their sexual orientation or just in the way they went through life, instead of being discriminated against and bullied, were valued for their difference? If that were seen as part of the great diversity of humanity? What if there were no more one part of society exploiting the others, and those exploited had no choice but to enrich them in order to be able to live themselves, working their whole life away under conditions of this ruthless exploitation? What if we didn't have to live in a lopsided world where a small number and a small number of countries have accumulate tremendous wealth by exploiting the great majority, and the conditions of the great majority are desperate? Look at the world. Look at the phenomenon of Ebola. There's been a lot of concern about Ebola, rightly so, but way too much hysterical fear about whether a few people here might get Ebola, and not nearly enough concern about what is happening to the people in Africa.
That's right. Absolutely.
What if there were no more wars for domination and plunder? What if there were whole different relations among people, valuing each other's humanity? What if there were different relation to the environment, protecting it and providing for future generations instead of despoiling and ruining it? What if we could have a whole different outlook on life and on the future instead of one of dread and one of desperately striving just to make it? Now, to paraphrase John Lennon's song, Imagine, you may say I'm a dreamer, but this is not just a dream. It is something for which there is a definite basis in reality, and it is up to us, together with people throughout the world, to make it a reality.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, and we were listening to a piece from his DVD, Revolutionary Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, and this piece was called What If? That's right. What if the world could be a whole different place? And if you want to watch the entire dialogue, go to revcom.us. And believe me, it's really worth it. It'll blow your mind. All right. I want to thank everybody involved in the show today. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.